Well, welcome to Talk Without Borders. I'm your host, John Pitti. All right, we're already at episode 5. It's been quite an enjoyable journey so far. Lots of interesting conversations and insights, and hopefully many more to come. In this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with Dietmar Heidemann. Dietmar is a professor of philosophy at the University of Luxembourg and the current chair of the Kant Society, one of the leading academic societies dedicated to the philosophy of Immanuel Kant. Dietmar is an expert in modern philosophy and ethics, and in our conversation we explored how philosophy can help us navigate the challenges of the digital age. We talked about how critical thinking and philosophical frameworks can help us evaluate the information we consume online, the ethical dilemmas around artificial intelligence, and why it's more important than ever to distinguish between knowledge and information in today's fast-moving media environment. We also touched on the role of religion in modern society, the state of public discourse, and how digital habits are shaping the way we think and communicate. But enough said, please enjoy the conversation with Dietmar Heidemann. Hello, Dietmar. Welcome to my podcast.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, you have a pretty interesting vita, and as I was looking at what you've done so far in your career, I was wondering, how did you get into the field of philosophy, especially nowadays, right? But I think parents ask or talk to their kids, and they usually tell them to do what I would say, quote, safe jobs, right? Which might be business or banking. Those kind of fields. So how did you get into this a little less conventional field?
Well, this was very early at school, actually, when I think I received a very good education in terms of religion, and part of religion, I think it was in 8th, 9th grade, some basic philosophy, intro philosophy of religion, ontological proof of the existence of God and these kinds of things. So that got me interested. And then later in 10th, 11th grade, we had a working group on philosophy. And so I got interested and I made it into a program in Cologne, and I was excited, continued successfully. In the end, I got my master, my PhD, and then the infamous German habilitation. And luckily, I got a job first in New York and then later in Luxembourg.
So what particularly about the philosophy did you find interesting? Was it the questions of ethics, knowledge, truth? So there's multiple angles about philosophy that might have been attractive to you at some point or another.
Yeah, I mean, to start with, I wasn't particularly interested in any specific field. I just thought that the rigorous method and the rigorous way of analysis of, say, any kinds of claims, theories, views, that got me attracted. And then, of course, later on, I specialized in theoretical philosophies and ethics in various, or in a specific sense, say, not in general ethics so much.
So you said that you went to New York first, and then you got a job at the professor at the University of Luxembourg. Did you notice any differences in terms of the culture and the views and perspectives people have on philosophy in the United States versus maybe more the European context, such as Luxembourg?
Yeah, there's an enormous difference. I mean, in terms of education, so the way philosophy is taught and to what students' philosophy is taught. For example, the school where I taught, I had to do intro ethics courses to not just philosophy students, because philosophy or ethics was a mandatory course for students of physics, biology, chemistry, business, and many, many other fields. So that is, I guess, still what makes philosophy a very strong discipline at U.S. universities, because usually you have these mandatory courses that other students from other fields must take.
Mm-hmm. So is that a way of, like, saying that philosophy kind of intersects with other fields in ways that people might not think or about on a regular basis?
Yeah, definitely. And students appreciate this. Yeah, they appreciate this very much. The business students or students in physics, we sometimes drag over or did drag over to philosophy. So it's certainly not so much interdisciplinary in the narrow sense of the word. It's rather that we are able, so philosophy is able via ethics courses to open up a perspective that was not on a student's mind. And they usually appreciate it a lot.
This brings me to a really important question, I think, is, you know, as we move on as a culture into a more and more digital space, what is the role of philosophy, especially now with how the world has changed and how habits of people have changed in terms of how they use their computer, you know, basically every day, they write emails, they communicate with each other. So how does philosophy fit into this more modern context?
Yeah, philosophy, I think, plays a major role here. To start with, of course, ethics-wise, so to speak, ethical evaluation, and we can talk about that later on maybe, but in the more general sense, I think philosophy is capable of analyzing the use of, say, digital media in the sense that philosophy can, for example, now stop the ongoing current debate or put it to a halt in order to reflect on really what we are doing and what the challenges are, what the problems are, what the expectations are, what the danger is, maybe even in moral or ethical terms. I think philosophy has always been good in starting a reflection process before moving on. And this is, I think, what we do. I mean, if you think of, I don't know whether you followed the 2 years back, 20th birthday celebration of the University of Luxembourg. The university did invite a professor, Sarah Stuckman from Oxford, to deliver the keynote speech. And she mentioned, she's not a philosopher, but she highlighted the role of philosophy in the digital age and pointed out that philosophy has its say. It's very important for philosophy to give, well, ethical advice, but not just that, also analytical capacities that can maybe help to better understand what is going on.
So if I understand this correctly, would you say that philosophy would give you a framework, so to speak, to understand what is going on in the digital world nowadays?
Yeah, in the specific sense that philosophy, not so much in terms of technological, say, evaluation, that's on the side of computer science, right, and other experts. But philosophy can help to set the frame for analyzing what we are facing in terms of data. I mean, if you think of the overwhelming mass of information, basically data that we have, to organize and understand them, right? Not so, as I said, not so much from the computer science perspective, but rather from the science, from the perspective of giving a rational sort of categorization, do it rigorously, yeah? Distinguishing between knowledge and information. I think this is one of the biggest problems we are facing.
And how so? How would you make that distinction?
Well, the distinction is that usually what we label knowledge, yeah. So, you know, Luxembourg is a knowledge-driven society, it is said. Yeah? Mm-hmm. What you find then in these, say, explanations or in publications on what that means, you rather find an explanation of what data is. So knowledge is conceived of as data, as information, right? But that's, of course, not the case. We are, of course, aware that information is very important, that data is very important, since we make probably our decisions based on information as data. But knowledge is different because knowledge is a mental state, right? And information or data is not. Data is just
Could you give an example? So as to, let's say, what would be categorized as information and what you would categorize as knowledge?
Information in terms of data, so some kind of information that you receive via, say, the internet.
Sure, like statistics,
well, that kind statistics of stuff. Or yeah. Just if you use Google Maps and you get some kind of, well, digits, or you get some kind of very formal description of where you are right now, the name of the street, and where you want to go, then this is, as such, just data, but data needs interpretation, of course. Yeah? And this, if you're lucky, generates knowledge. So the understanding of where you are, which, of course, implicates that you are, or you have certain kinds of capacities that make you understand where you are and how you use these data, how you get from A to B. Now, so this is a very, very simple case, of course. But on the large, it's a really important distinction that needs to be made and needs to be kept in mind when talking of knowledge society and in the digital age.
So specifically, and I don't want to get too technical, but this is something that in preparation I found very interesting, and this is something, you are also a Kantian expert, right? So you specifically focus on the works of Immanuel Kant, A Critique of Pure Reason, is I think his main work. And so in this context, I read a little bit about it. So in terms of navigating the digital landscape, is it useful, in your opinion, to look at the more, and maybe you can explain these terms, deontological perspective, which I think is more of a perspective that Kant has, versus utilitarian? Are those two frameworks useful? And could you maybe explain those two frameworks in this context?
Yeah, sure. Maybe before I start, since you mentioned Kant, so what is important, we've just touched up on this, the role of philosophy, why is philosophy important or relevant with respect to our digital age or culture? So, as I said, the capacities that we need in order to somehow tackle the challenges of today's world is to develop the competencies to use the sources of information we have, the digital sources, of course. Yeah, so not just newspapers or books and paper copies. Yeah, and this is actually what has been focused on by Kant. So Kant's philosophy is important in the modern and even contemporary age, because Kant's focus is on the analysis of the sources of cognition or knowledge, if you like. And I think this is something we really need to keep in mind. We have to have a framework for how to use the sources, critically use the sources of the information we have. So to say this before I now turn to the difference between deontology and utilitarianism, or we could even mention other kinds of ethics, moral theories like virtue ethics, for example. Deontology is very broadly construed, so the kind or type of ethics that Kant is arguing for, duty ethics. Yeah? I do not want to get too technical here, because this would probably be not as interesting with respect at least to the question of ethics in the digital age. But what is key for Kant is that the human being is a rational cognizer who has a free will, and the condition of the possibility of acting morally, of moral actions, is being an autonomous being, an autonomous rational being that has the capacity to self-legislate, so to act according to rules or maxims, Kant calls them, that spring from the individual's self-reflection.
So if I understand this correctly, it's moral guidance. It's guided by moral principles.
Yeah, well, that's also the case with utilitarianism. Utilitarianism too has the principle, but the principle of utilitarianism
is the outcome.
In a sense, yeah, the outcome, very broadly construed. And this is not what Kant thinks can serve as the principle of moral actions, since the outcome is, for Kant, rather arbitrary. Yeah, if it is, say, the happiness of the majority of people, the most, the outcome in that very broad sense. For Kant, this is highly ambiguous, and maybe personal, merely subjective, and doesn't work as a moral principle. It's rather that the autonomy, free will, must serve as the principle, which then is in the end the famous categorical imperative. Yeah. So that in the most general sense. And how is this related, of course, to our contemporary world of digital culture? Sure. When it comes to what nowadays is labeled, has been labeled a while ago as digital ethics, then we must be aware that digital ethics is not just an independent sort of new kind of ethics. It is, of course, new because it refers to our contemporary challenges, but digital ethics is a branch of ethics. Yeah? And ethics is a branch of philosophy. And when it comes to the question, so how should digital ethics look like, yeah, as a branch or a sub-discipline of ethics, then, of course, we need to look back to what kinds of theories are on the table. Yeah? So what kind of, or by what kind of criteria do we want to develop this kind of digital ethics that may help us to get along with contemporary challenges in the digital world? And those kinds of theories that are helpful, such as maybe Kantian deontology or utilitarianism or virtue ethics, this is not new, right? This is those are the available proposals that are on the table. And this is what needs to be decided, really, from the start off, because you cannot do digital ethics just from scratch. No, you are thrown back to the existing theories that you have, or you come up with a completely new one. But that doesn't seem to be the case.
So especially from a humanities perspective, so basically those are age-old questions, right? But just in a new context, right? So I guess what you're saying is we need to find how these older theories that are hundreds of years old, how they fit into this more contemporary context.
Yeah, exactly. And this is happening now for decades. It doesn't mean that contemporary ethics is simply referring back to Kant or to Plato or to Aristotle and say, okay, now we simply go by their ethical standards that they proposed 2,000 years ago or 300 years ago. No, what happened in the meantime is, of course, that we have adaptations or modernizations already of these rather historical theories, yeah. But still, we need criteria in digital ethics by means of which decisions can be made, yeah. And which one is the best theory that provides these criteria or standards that help us, as I said, to cope with or somehow respond to the contemporary challenges.
So one of the contemporary challenges, at least from my perspective, is the what I call the internet discussion culture. It is something I find very interesting. So I would say that the norms of discourse, I guess you could call it, in the online space seems to be so fundamentally different from real life interaction sometimes. I don't know if you probably wandered into a comment section or some forum, or it seems to me that the online space has different rules almost, and people act differently in the online space as they would in their private life. Is that something that philosophy concerns itself with, this kind of like difference in the culture of conversation?
Sure, of course. I mean, this cannot be denied, and you would need to take this into account when developing, say, the guidelines, the rules, or the moral or ethical principles we should go by. But the question is, of course, whether we should modify the standards that we take to be, well, the guiding principles for our moral interactions simply because the format is different from what it used to be, right? When it comes to, say, in the comment section, in whatever kind of social network you are, cases of bad behavior, say, then I think no other principle should apply on the very fundament, at least, that is different from our analog exchanges, right? Because bad behavior remains bad behavior. Although I'm not saying that in practice this can as easily be applied, since when it comes to, for example, if you have an online format, as we have it in academia, for example, online conferences, and you have discussions on papers, and sometimes maybe discussions can be rough, then of course you need someone who maybe stops you, who directly intervenes, so someone who organizes the session maybe, And this is, of course, not fundamentally different from the analog case where you have conferences where you sit together, discuss, and maybe discussions develop in a direction that you do not want to have. Then, of course, in the digital space, it's different from the analog. So you have to have maybe someone who does the
moderation.
Those ones who maybe do not behave the way they should.
So obviously, since we're talking about ethics, I think one of the biggest issues right now is artificial intelligence, and how these AI systems are going to develop, and our relationship or the human relationship with this artificial intelligence as it progresses seems to me like there's a lot of unanswered questions where maybe ethics can play a role in telling us how to deal with these developments.
Yeah, this is, of course, one of the core areas where ethics of AI, as it is labeled nowadays, plays its role and is, I guess, really important. Again, to start with, I think that we should systematically first make or try to make it clear what artificial intelligence is. So I do not want to know. Enter a discussion of what artificial intelligence is, of course, but at least...
No, I think it's important to define it. Yeah,
it's really relevant, since if you just think of artificial and then intelligence is something we as human beings only know from our own case, right? So the label AI is, of course, tricky, since the word intelligence is here attributed to something that is fundamentally different from our kind of rationalizing. Yeah? But we only know it from our own case. We only know non-artificial intelligence, namely human intelligence. So that's already a tricky thing, but maybe in the end the question of defining how you think a definition of artificial intelligence should look like. But at least this is something we should be aware of, because this probably forces us, or at least constrains us, to evaluate ethically artificial intelligence and its consequences based on our human standards. I think this is already a fundamental decision that has been made, but at least something we should be aware of when it comes to the more concrete cases and, of course, the development of the standards by means of which we describe, analyze, and then evaluate artificial intelligence.
Are you concerned about the development of AI in a sense where do you conceive it's possible that at some point we're going to lose control over what AI does? And, once we reach this general artificial intelligence, as they call it, level, where I don't know if we'll ever get there. I think we will, but I don't know when. And we get to that stage where AI systems will become almost autonomous in their thinking, in their level of consciousness. Is that something you're worried about, especially from an ethical perspective?
I think from an ethical perspective, of course, but I think this is the second step. The first step is really to make it clear, and it's still undecided. I personally think it's very unlikely, but it's still undecided whether artificial intelligence can reach the kind of level that we understand as, say, rationality, autonomy, and in particular, self-consciousness. consciousness and self-consciousness, those topics are very old topics. This is what philosophy is debating now for more than 100 years. If we think of the 20s, 30s, the 19th century, of the 20th century, you find philosophers claiming that within the next 20 years, we're going to have solved the problem of consciousness. Yeah, but it didn't happen. So it was predicted, but there is progress that has been made, no doubt. But it's still...
When you say solve the problem of consciousness, what does that mean exactly?
Yeah, solve the problem of consciousness in terms of the best scientific methods we have, such that we can maybe realize consciousness on artificial devices such as computer, right? So that you have some kind of, robot, which is another word for saying so. It's a non-human artificial.
It's an anthropomorphized form of artificial intelligence. Yeah.
Right. So, and I think this is really crucial, since nowadays most philosophers would argue that, for example, when it comes to knowledge, a presupposition of the possibility of knowledge is self-consciousness, or at least consciousness. Right? You cannot have knowledge of whatever sort without being conscious, and I would even say self-conscious. So this would mean that if we attribute knowledge to those kinds of devices, so to artificial intelligence, this would then mean that these devices, artificial intelligence, would have consciousness and self-consciousness. So this is at the very bottom, and it's really important for the following reason, since many moral philosophers and ethical theories, more broadly construed, okay, different as they are, but would one way or the other argue that moral action that lead to morally good or bad actions require knowledge and therefore consciousness and maybe even self-consciousness, such that if you think that AI is one day maybe capable of moral actions, then this can only be the case if it is clear that AI has or is capable of self-consciousness. And this is something that seems to be at this point very, very unlikely.
Well, let's spin, because I think you're right. So, and if you look at the field right now, obviously, and I think the one thing we know is that we don't really know what AI is going to look like in 10 years, 50 years, 100 years, right? So there's really no way of even the people that are in the know and that are developing all these, you know, great applications, the robots and everything, even they probably can't tell you exactly when we get to that level or if we're going to get to that level. But let's just say we are, okay? Let's just say in a distant future, we're going to get to this point where AI is going to be self-conscious. What would that mean for us as humans, if that were ever the case? Would this be, to me at least, in my imagination, that seems like a very dangerous situation, because if I put myself in the shoes of the artificial intelligence, I'd be like, well, what do I need the human for, right? I mean, I can reason better than him. I have a much faster access to information, and at that point, probably knowledge, and I do everything faster and better and more efficient. So in a way, I guess what I'm getting back to is, are we basically eradicating ourselves in a sense if we keep pushing AI into this state of self-consciousness, well, if we ever get there?
Yeah, right. So the fact that, as it looks, AI is not capable of consciousness or self-consciousness right now, these days, this might change within the next 10, 20, 30, or whatever, 500 years.
Sure.
Well, the first consequence would be, no matter whether artificial intelligence is then in a way better performance-wise than human agency, yeah, or rationality, we would need, in the first place, we would need to treat those entities that have artificial intelligence, robots, computers, or whatsoever, as beings that have the same dignity, moral dignity, as we have. So they, if they are autonomous entities, say, beings, maybe, yeah, also beings, if they are autonomous, then they are responsible for what they do. So they would be subject to moral and legal responsibility. Yeah, if they commit crimes, you would need to lock them up. Yeah, and so on and so forth. Even, and that's only the second question, even if they are intellectually better than the human being. So I think that's the first consequence. Whether there is a second, a level of threat, societal or even on the individual level, that artificial intelligence might at some point take over, that's, I think, a separate and independent question. Yeah, of course, we would, from our contemporary perspective, rather not want to have it, right? But still, in the future, I mean, it doesn't, it seems to be a threat, but there is right now no reason to, no, at least strong reason to think that this might not benefit us. It's, it could also be the case that it's beneficial.
Do you think that right now we need better regulation on the, or supervision on people that are developing AI? Do you think it's beneficial if we say we need a good framework, a regulatory framework, to make sure that the people that are developing all these new AI-related things are making sure that we don't lose control over the process? Do you think that's something that's important?
Yes, of course. Although I must say, so it, this is not for academia to do this. Academia, or say philosophy, is of course in charge of maybe providing ethical analysis, evaluation, maybe to a certain extent give advice, but it's of course administration and politics in particular and democratic societies that need to take these ideally findings, recommendations into account when deciding up on what the limits of these kinds of research looks like. But in general, yeah, of course, how could one not be cautious, even hesitant with respect to whether AI and research on AI should be limited?
I think that's a natural instinct, but I'm afraid that, you know, sometimes as people develop these applications, you know, they see that it works really well and it probably really good monetary wise. And, you know, so they might get ahead of themselves and they forget to put in the checks and balances, right? And then at some point, you know, especially from an ethical perspective, I think it's really important to clarify that when you develop such a potent agent as AI is, that you have a really a regulatory framework in place. But I'm not quite sure that is really happening, especially in the US right now, Silicon Valley. You know, you have quite a lot of companies that are pushing for the newest, best product, and they keep pushing and pushing. And, you know, we've seen this before in humanity that sometimes, you know, even with the best intentions, you know, you might actually end up with something that you didn't anticipate.
Sure. I mean, we cannot deny that this is, there's economics behind it, which drives the whole thing, yeah, gets support from politics, of course, right, under Trump in particular. We are witnessing these unfortunate developments, the other side of the Atlantic. But I think still, so the big question, ethical question, is whether at some point this level of, say, autonomy of artificial intelligence can be reached in principle. There might be reasons for why this cannot be reached. Yeah, it might be even technological principles, because if you think of spontaneity, yeah, can artificial intelligence be spontaneous and not just autonomous or both? This is really, I think, the issue that we would need to keep an eye on, which is the big game changer. Because if, according to the now existing standards, if we think that at some point artificial intelligence can reach that level, then we must treat artificial intelligence, robots as human beings. There is no escape. Yeah? Since those are the standards defined, I think, or agreed upon, that a human being is a being that has rational capacities, that has the capacity of autonomy, and so on and so forth, with the things that we've just been talking about, and that we cannot, therefore, treat this being as a non-human being, right? So I think this is really the crucial game changer in the future if this materializes. Yeah, it might well be that there are technological reasons for why this is impossible.
So in a way, you say that they would be under the same laws and they would have the same rights as the human beings, and if that were ever to develop to that stage.
Sure. If we agree, as we do nowadays, that humans being are autonomous, rational beings that are capable of being conscious and self-consciousness, that have certain kinds of rational capacities, and if this should apply in the future to AI and the relevant, say, devices, then we would need to treat them, and we cannot take it back, right? If we say, okay, now this device has reached the level of consciousness and self-consciousness, it's an autonomous, it has language, we can talk, yeah, and we are not treating it like just an automated machine, yeah, then in that case, I think that no matter what we are, as a consequence, we must draw the conclusion, yeah, it is in the full sense a being that has all the rights and duties as we have, a human being has, even if it's not human in the sense we use human with respect to ourselves.
Yeah, so since you were talking about knowledge and rationality and humans, a different topic or slightly different topic I wanted to discuss with you is the issue of religion in our modern age. So I read this really interesting article. Unfortunately, it was behind a paywall, so I didn't actually read all of it. It was with you and the vicar of Luxembourg, and you had quite an interesting conversation about the role of religion, especially in Luxembourg, I suppose. So what is the role of religion in our modern society? Has it run its course? Is there even use for it still now, especially as, you know, technology evolves, our understanding of science constantly evolves? So how does religion still fit in to this rapid evolution or pace of modern society?
Yeah, that's the big question, whether it fits in at all, yeah, or whether it rather provides an alternative, say, perspective or even existential framework. It cannot be denied. I mean, just given the fact that a few years ago, Habermas, in a way, turned back to religion, at least as a topic, right, of philosophical or more broadly societal reflection. And this is so, I guess, for good reason, since religion is, of course, something that religion, in the broad sense, I should say, as the attitude or reflection we have to a divine being, whatever you think that divine being is. Yeah, there are all other kinds of understandings of what religion is, but maybe I limit it to this sense. The reason for why there is the turn back, in a way at least, to religion, I think, is really that it opens up a perspective that sort of makes it possible to escape the challenges and maybe even the constraints and threats of our contemporary world in terms of digitalization, digital culture, things that we've just been talking about, and of course, economic constraints, and these days, threats of our democratic societies. So I would say that there is, of course, pressure, as we all know, on religion and church, and the churches in particular. But the function or significance of religion in the modern age fits in there, in that direction. So to have sort of the possibility of refer to a domain that is independent of these rather existential threats and maybe digital challenges that we are facing.
So I think you're right when you say that. So probably for a lot of people, religion is an escape from reality, is what I would call it, or from the constraints that you said of our contemporary society. But one issue I have, and that's always bothered me, you know, as someone that has really thought about this a lot, is the problem with religion that I see is that there is just no way, because we were talking about knowledge and truth, there's just no way to empirically assess the truth of a belief in God. That always seems to me the biggest challenge, is that if you think long enough about religion, you probably find a lot of reason why it's not valid or truthful, because we do not have an empirical evidence for example, the existence of God.
Sure, but you may just presuppose that truth requires empirical evidence. Yeah, this might be the case.
Yes, that's how I would see it, yes.
The contemporary, of course, contemporary society, if we look at into science, for example, the hard, what some think are the hard sciences, then, of course, there is no evidence whatsoever for the existence of God. So even a scientist, I mean, if you are a physicist nowadays, then it seems to be very hard to think that there is any kind of evidence for the existence of God. Yeah,
I think it would be exceptionally hard for physicists, because physicists have such a rigor for evidence and all the demands, and to then just turn around and just relinquish those need for evidence for your personal belief seems to me a very hard thing to do.
Right. And therefore, I guess what many religious people would object is rather, yeah, that's the reason for why we do not know the existence of a divine being, of God, but rather we believe in God. Yeah, so this is the difference between knowing and believing. And I think this is a valid, it's a very important distinction to be drawn, whatever you think this distinction ends up with, yeah, whether it's helpful or not, but it's definitely a fundamental difference to argue, I know the existence of God. I can even provide a proof of the existence of God, and the mere religious belief that is not empirically founded, but has its roots in, well, faith. That's the main challenge nowadays that we have. It's not new, actually. But it's something that came.
No, I agree. But I think that the challenge is that I feel like in no aspect of our life would we lower our standards so much as that we would say, oh, I have faith, this is going to work. But we're not going to put our faith in our finances or important decisions, right? We want to actually know. We want to have evidence. You know, we require evidence. But for some reason, in this aspect, it seems to be okay not to have evidence just for that particular aspect of religion. Isn't that a contradiction in a sense?
From the point of view of theoretical reasoning, yes, but it's not an irrational attitude, right? You can have rational belief in the existence of God without contradicting yourself, which means accepting that there is no empirical knowledge or empirical evidence, nor any kind of a priori, for example, mathematical evidence for the existence of God. Yeah. So no matter what, empirical or a priori, so non-empirical, you can still believe that God exists. Sure, from the point of view, from the internal point of view of, say, physics, or from our highest scientific standards that we accept, it's rather unlikely that God exists, yeah? Or it's not substantiated empirically that God exists.
One reason I could see people are turning towards religion might be what I would call the crisis of meaning, maybe in our modern society. So is it possible that some people perceive a lack of meaning in their life, and that turning to religion is something that might be beneficial?
Could be. That's a question of social sciences, I'd say. So we would need to do interviews and ask people. I mean, this is a plausible explanation. Yeah, I wouldn't deny that. Yeah, and this is something that is being discussed now for more than 100 years. But in the end, we need to have empirical evidence for this. So I'm not quite sure whether this question can be answered without further substantiation from empirical evidence in that case. But it's plausible. Yeah, it's a good explanation.
There's another thing. So basically, you know, since we live in what I call a time of misinformation, fake news, how do you think philosophy can help kind of adjusting people's perspective, maybe helping them understand how to distinguish between, as you said before, knowledge and truth? For example, when they read a news article, maybe help people, you know, identify if something is false or not true. Can philosophy help in that specific case?
Yeah, I mean, this is the core business of what philosophy is doing, coming to terms with those key concepts like knowledge, truth, information, data, maybe. And yes, I, of course, think that this is where philosophy can help. Even in everyday life, of course, if only philosophy sort of makes you think that before accepting a claim to verify it, right, on the internet, for example, this is trivial in a way, but still, it's very important that this kind of awareness comes back. So if I think of, many of our students who are not maybe entirely aware of that checking source. I mean, they're not naive, but maybe in real life, it's in everyday life, it's something that is not so much on their minds.
And I think you lived in the United States, for example, as well. And if when you compare, do you think there's a difference in terms of how Americans perceive information and deal with information versus how Europeans do it?
Yeah, there are major differences, although I rather really do not want to generalize. Yeah, so the U.S. is a big country, and we know that maybe the East is different from the West Coast. So I was at the East Coast, the University of New York, where I was. In general, I would say, there's, of course, a much greater, say, openness towards technology and maybe a rather, in general, in that case, really a rather liberal attitude towards any kind of innovation, technological innovation, which might be good on the one end, but which has, of course, its downsides. There is no critical attitude, of course, as we sometimes find it here. We can see these days again, where many of us may be disappointed about the lack of protests against Musk's decisions and, of course, Trump himself. So this is, in a way, representative of maybe a less critical attitude in many sense. But
well, I don't want to. Yeah, I think we should avoid generalizations. But I think what I've noticed is since the Trump phenomenon has entered the building, so to speak, I think Trump has fundamentally changed how people perceive information. And so I give you an example. When Trump doesn't like something, his first instinct is to say fake news. Or even though it probably isn't, but people will hear it and they say, oh, Trump said it's fake news, therefore it must be fake news. And that's about the amount of critical evaluation that a lot of people do. So to me, that seems like a big problem that, you know, I think, you know, almost gets worse and worse over time. Is that something that you find concerning as well, especially from the perspective, from an ethical perspective?
Oh, yeah. This is, of course, something that should worry us tremendously. It's and this is the task that we have at schools, universities in particular, to get that back on the table, something that I guess over the last decades we have not so much been aware of or made.
So how can we do this practically?
Yeah, by at schools, but also at universities, universities maybe even first, since what are we doing? We are educating, providing education of, for example, for future school teachers who need to be educated, of course, in that domain, and especially how they then transfer their education that they received at universities into the schools, so in real practical life. And I take this as a long-term process. Yeah, we are only at the beginning to develop the necessary means and level of reflection that we need to, in the future, become much, much better to cope with these challenges, such that it is not the case that, coming back to example, someone who hears Trump say fake news to not roll his or her eyes and say, oh, what kind of sort of description is this, or claim or superstition is this? So I think this is something we have to work on hard, really, now and in the future in particular.
So is it, in a way, the importance here should be to equip people with the necessary skills to critically evaluate information? Is that something?
Yeah, that's exactly that. Yeah, and this is also the reason why, I mean, the standard courses, or one of the standard courses at U.S. universities, is critical thinking. Yeah, critical thinking is a mandatory course for all, usually for all students at U.S. universities. And maybe this is something from where we can start. Maybe do it even better, in a better way, such focusing on some kind of digital ethics, for example, or ethics and digital culture, and to make students at university level, and maybe even at school level, aware of why this kind of thinking, maybe critical thinking and reflection, is crucial for somehow getting along in our contemporary world.
Is that something that, in your years of experience teaching at universities, did you notice a decline of critical thinking or particular skills, or has that been more or less the same over the years?
No, there's certainly a decline. And I think I'm not exaggerating, and my colleagues would one way or the other agree in that this is declining. I don't know what the reasons are. I mean,
I have some ideas, but you know, they might not be scientifically founded yet. But I do think that, for example, a lot of young people now are using Instagram, Snapchat. I'm sure you're familiar with these. And I think they're eradicating attention span and critical thinking, because the dopamine levels, they hit and they hit and they hit when people watch the little screens on their tablets. And I think these moving into these short-term videos kind of, you know, eradicates our critical thinking capacities, right? So that, like, a long-form conversation like we have right now is sometimes a hard sell, I think, to younger people, because they're so used to getting their information in such a tiny little clip, and it has to be, you know, it has to be hit right. So there is, so I think that might be one of the reasons why this is happening.
I agree. I think you're right. This is without having enough really empirical.
That's just my instinct.
That's exactly, at least that's the observation I make, that it is very difficult for many, many, I'm not saying all students, to focus or concentrate on a printed text on a piece of paper and read it, analyze it, and that keeps you busy maybe for 30 minutes. Right.
But let's now introduce another aspect, which is ChatGPT, right? Whereas when we went to school, you know, even when I finished my dissertation, my PhD dissertation, I had to write everything myself. I had to do all the research. I had to prepare all the stimuli for my experiment and everything, right? There was no ChatGPT. Now I'm wondering, well, if people are now writing their papers, so I'm not in academia anymore, but I wonder, are they not heavily relying on ChatGPT now, in a sense that some of the evaluation that we did before when we wrote our papers and we did that kind of work, which is, I think, hard work, right? I think writing a scientific paper, as you know, is hard work. It requires a lot of commitment, time, effort. So are we shortcutting, or are people maybe shortcutting some of the critical variation necessary to complete these tasks, and, you know, dividing some of their work to ChatGPT?
Yeah, of course. I mean, we cannot deny that plagiarism is a problem at universities, schools now for, I don't know, 10, 20 years. It's getting worse. And now ChatGPT is coming and generative AI, which makes things not easier for teachers, professors to decide whether this originates from the student or whether it's...
Do you personally have an instinct for when somebody uses ChatGPT, or is that something that you might have an intuition for it, but you can't prove it, I guess, in some cases?
At this point, I still do, and my colleagues agree. So we've been discussing this. This might change within the next 5, 10, or 15 years, or maybe 2 years, 3 months, for the following reason. So you can, it's fairly easy to see whether a philosophy paper, and I'm talking about philosophy now,
sure,
whether a paper in philosophy is a product of ChatGPT or whatever, an AI product. Since AI is not yet at the level of really producing something that is a good philosophical paper, at this point, as I said, this might change. So there are certain indications.
So you're saying philosophical reasoning is not quite the strong suit of ChatGPT?
Yeah, I mean, what ChatGPT or AI does is rather give you some sort of descriptive, general output that you find.
Generic in a sense.
Yeah, it's very generic. Mm. It's not analytic. You won't have the kind of spontaneous idea thing that you find in well-written papers. Yeah, as I said, this might change, but for now, it's still, I think, detectable, easily detectable. But my hope is actually, and that's maybe another philosophical question even, whether ChatGPT or AI in general is capable of developing a tool that detects AI generated papers itself.
You mean AI generates a tool that helps you detect if it's written by AI?
That should be possible, right?
I think it would, but it's kind of ironic that you would rely on AI to create a software that helps detecting plagiarism.
But if we think that AI is helpful and reliable, then this should be possible, right? I mean, already now we are relying on, if you think of the standard detection programs that we have,
But I think they're not really good. And I think I read some studies on it that there's a lot of false positives. I think the systems, that the software we have right now is quite bad, at least from my understanding.
Yeah, they are not working AI-wise, since they are basically screening the servers, where are similarities between the paper under review and maybe papers that have been submitted. Yeah, and they really rely on the data they have.
Are you actually making students cite or make them cite that they use ChatGPT? Is that something that you discuss in class?
Oh, yeah. 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 That's, I clearly, and my colleagues do this as well, I clearly pointed out that any use of sources other than your non-artificial intelligence, analog intelligence, say, must be identified. But another way of maybe helping yourself out here is to ask or to give exam questions or paper essay topics that are highly specific, very, very specific, and make it rather, I'm not saying unlikely, but at least less likely that ChatGPT, the internet or whatsoever is helpful here. If you ask them to interpret these two lines of a text and refer to specifically those words or similar strategies. But as I said, this might change very quickly, and then we are facing a new challenges, and we need to see how to get along then.
Yeah, I mean, this is great. I mean, this is really a lot of important things I think we discussed today. And as you said, you know, we don't know what challenges are necessarily ahead of ourselves, but I think, as you pointed out, philosophy or ethics specifically can be quite powerful for helping people deal with these uncertainties and deal with these challenges so they can find a good way to deal with the changes ahead. So thanks so much, Dietmar, for coming on. It was very interesting.
Thank you, John. It was a pleasure.